start by thanking our sponsors that make this possible. We're extremely grateful to Salt Lake Community College for being this year's presenting sponsor. AT&T is our major sponsor. Comcast is a supporting sponsor. And Rocky Mountain Power is our community partner sponsor. This is our fourth year of doing a speaker series about racial equity. It's long been our core work to address racial inequities in education, health, and our economic systems. We do that every day by building partnerships with many of you and working to achieve measurable results and improvements in core outcomes from cradle to career. The speaker series is one way, though, that we can broaden the conversation and come together and learn together and then act together. That's what we're doing today, and we're glad that you're here. Thank you for joining us. Please note that we have closed captioning available for this event. To access live closed captioning on Zoom, select Show Subtitle in the Closed Caption or More menu. To view the full transcript, visit the link that was just sent in the chat box. Before we begin, I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the long overdue and momentous changes we've seen in the last year regarding broader recognition, awareness, and action around racial equity and justice. Part of our commitment to building on and expanding that awareness is recognizing that the land we're on, where we live and where we work for equity, is the traditional territory of the Eastern Shoshone and Goshute peoples. We want to honor those who have stewarded this land and acknowledge a need to address the continued inequities experienced by Indigenous peoples. We're now going to hear from Denise Hufteland by a video, president of Salt Lake Community College. She has been an incredible champion of the work that we are doing of advancing higher education and post-secondary completion for young people in our community. She's been an incredible champion for equity. We're glad and grateful and honored to be partnered with Salt Lake Community College, and would love for you to hear from her now.
Welcome to the 2021 Building Equitable Communities Speaker Series, where through three robust conversations, we will take a deeper look at race and diversity in America. We are excited to host this year's speakers, all of whom will bring their expertise and perspective to illuminate truths and inspire us to start conversations about these complex issues in our community. Given the year we have just been through and the continuing dialogue and call to action regarding systemic racism and social injustices, these conversations are more necessary than ever. And as the community's college, Salt Lake Community College is proud to join United Way as a presenting sponsor. We need to be a leader alongside other organizations in interrogating our own practices and policies and strengthening the level of inclusion and trust we build for students, faculty, and staff of color and other groups who have been historically marginalized. As the most racially and ethnically diverse higher education institution in the state of Utah, we know that diversity is an asset to the learning environment. But we also know that without equitable and safe environments, diverse students, staff, or faculty may not succeed to their full potential. So we are glad you decided to join us and look forward to deep, engaging, and action-oriented dialogues. Thanks for being with us.
We're incredibly grateful to have Denise and the partnership of Salt Lake Community College working with us on this project. We're also incredibly grateful to have with us today Jim Shelton, Chief Investment and Impact Officer of Blue Meridian Partners. Jim is a national leader in this work around racial inequities, the career that includes work in both the private sector, philanthropy, and in the public sector, the U.S. Department of Education, where he was the founding director of My Brother's Keeper, and where he led the development of the Promised Neighborhoods Initiative, around which we've modeled much of our work here in Salt Lake. We'll learn more about his work as we get into the discussion, but thank you, Jim, for joining us this afternoon. Before we get into the discussion, please draw your attention to the Q&A box. You can submit questions via that Q&A box that you have for Jim towards the end of the program. We'll try to answer as many as we can. Jim, welcome. And to get started, tell us a little bit about the work of Blue Meridian Partners and the Place Matters Initiative.
Sure. Blue Meridian Partners is a philanthropic collaborative that brings together high net worth individuals and foundations to invest in solutions that work. It starts with that fundamental belief that to any given social problem, there are actually solutions out there. Sometimes we haven't found them. Sometimes they've been under-resourced, but you need to actually, once you find them, you've got to do your very best to get them to the people who need them. What we recognize, though, is that finding those kind of solutions is inadequate, that in order to really get the benefit to people, you have to find ways to compound them, stacking them on top of each other so that you actually, from a time a child is born to the time that they become a thriving adult, are putting the supports in place to help them along the way, especially when they're born into poverty. Well, the only way you can actually do that work is by aligning them in a place. And as we know more and more, it's in the closer you are to where they live, the more it matters to how things turn out. And so our work is called Place Matters because it does, and being able to change people's life trajectories by intervening and providing supports from the beginning to the end of their lives. Last thing I'll say is we have had the good fortune of investing in 12 communities, of which Salt Lake City is one. And had previously invested in two other communities. What we are also, though, hoping to do is to create the infrastructure for the next 100 communities that want to do this work.
Awesome. We'll hear more about that. Let's go a little bit further on introduction and just have you tell us a little bit about yourself and what drew you to this work.
Sure. So I'm here with you tonight from Washington, D.C., which is also where I happen to be born. I was born in the part of D.C. where people tell you not to go is the easiest way to explain it. And I had the good fortune of going to school outside of my community. And what I found out very quickly, by the time I was in third grade, I was at a good friend of mine's house and wound up helping his brother, who I admired, but who was in sixth grade, with his homework. And I realized that he was smart and he was a lot of things that I wasn't. And yet I was getting a very different opportunity than he had. I wanted to be actually go into education. And my mom was like, no, you actually need to go make money. And so I went off to do a bunch of other stuff. And as you described about my career, one of the things that happened along the way was I benchmarked successful economic and community development efforts around the country. And in doing so, I just came away with one thing. There are no silver bullets. In fact, it is the culmination of many things that come together to help people along that pathway that we've talked about, but also to create the context for them to actually do that in a safe, a place that they belong, in a place that has the kind of housing and amenities that they need to be able to thrive. And so that's led me to want to lean into this work over the long term. And it's shown up in my life in various ways since then.
Two of the things that you were instrumental in developing are now national initiatives that are taking root in communities across the country. The Promise Neighborhoods Program and My Brother's Keeper Initiative. Can you talk to us a little bit about the motivation behind both of those and where you see those going in the future?
Sure. So, I mean, I can only take credit for being able to help execute on actually a vision that was created before me. On Promise Neighborhoods, then President Obama was very excited about what he had seen as a candidate in the Harlem Children's Zone. And actually it was Angela Blackwell from PolicyLink and Jeff Canada who did a great job of informing the work of that team to think about when we were standing up the Recovery Act. You know, people forget how bad things were at the end of 2008 and beginning of 2009. There was a Recovery Act at that point in time. And there was a big commitment at that point made to invest very specifically in actually supporting the long-term transformation of education. Not just stimulating the economy directly. And one of those things was Promise Neighborhoods. And it was designed to help communities just like Harlem that were hard hit, build the infrastructure that the Harlem Children's Zone had learned about over that time period of time. That starting from that very beginning, if you remember, they had a baby college, but then doing evidence-based practices all the way through someone's life could lead them to a thriving adulthood. But it took a strong partnership in a community to be able to do that. And so that's why we designed the program the way we did, to say, hey, look, use data to tell you whether you're going after outcomes that matter, have those outcomes span across someone's life. You don't have to do it all at once, but you have to have a plan to get there. And most importantly, don't do it alone. So that was the one. And then the second, my brother's keeper, you know, it was born out of tragedy. Many folks may remember that when Trayvon Martin was killed, President Obama famously went on television and said that we need to show young men that they were valued, that Trayvon Martin very much could have easily been his son. And then he came out after that and said, how do we actually do that? And it was from that work that we started designing My Brother's Keeper. And it was in that context, again, that I was able to say, hey, what we've learned is that if you want to value people, you can't value them at one point in their life. You have to value them throughout their life. You have to create those communities where you benchmark those outcomes and you find ways to intervene that are going to matter for this specific population. Well, the great thing about this was two things. One is, once you start to disaggregate the data and try and figure out, well, what is going on for boys and young men of color, you actually have started to figure out, well, what's going on for everyone. And what you realize is that the pathway is the same. Like, all of us need to start school ready, and all of us need to be able to read in third grade and graduate from high school and so forth. But we all get hit with different obstacles along the way and at different points. And so once you start to design systems that work for young males of color that address the inequity that exists in our systems, you start to create systems that can address the inequity for everyone. So I was very fortunate to be able to lead that body of work, to lead it in terms of the public-private partnership work that happened outside of the administration, and to lead the policy work that was there to benefit all children inside the administration.
It's not coincidental then that the same cradle to career kind of infrastructure and focus exists in both programs.
No, at some point someone's going to realize that I'm kind of a one-trick pony, and that, you know, that kids' lives actually the research is very, very clear that the same milestones have mattered for a very long time. And the real question is, are we going to figure out ever how to actually give them what they need? There's a really important study I just like to mention it to get a little wonky for a second. It's been called since the time, something called Bloom's Two Sigma Problem. And it's a really interesting study because a guy who was an education researcher asked a very simple question. If you gave a young person basically a healthy environment and great support, how far could they go? Like, what was the potential of each child? And his proxy for that was like a safe environment, but also a one-to-one tutor who was trained. And this experiment where he did that for a child compared to a regular classroom famously became called the Two Sigma Problem. And it became called the Two Sigma Problem for two reasons. One is that with that kind of support, what he demonstrated was that he could take the average 50th percentile student and have them perform at the level of a 90th plus percentile student. The reason then that it became called the Two Sigma Problem then is, well, how do we ever afford to provide children one-to-one tutors? But the reason I bring this up right now is that it's really important to remember that since he's done that now, we know that is never actually, almost exclusively, never the child. Like, we now know that we can do this. The only question is, are we going to be creative enough, courageous enough, and generous enough to give our kids what they need to be successful at that level, to fully realize their potential?
That I think opens up the door to this question around, some might hear this and say, well, we need more programs only. And what you're talking about seems like a more collective choice about how we design the systems themselves. And what role does public policy have in all of that?
Sure. So one of the things that you heard me describe is there are milestones that matter in someone's life. There are interventions that actually work. And the question is, how do you build systems that, one, make it easy to adopt and adapt and scale those things? And more importantly, how do you integrate them so you get the compounding benefits of someone going from one successful support or intervention or strategy inside a school building to the next? How do you actually help people organize so that you have a system of continuous improvement? Because very few of our solutions actually get to that level of performance that I was talking about? How do you actually organize people around collective work? Because it's very seldom that any of these big problems are going to be solved inside one of our core institutions. Our schools cannot do it alone. And so there is the work of saying, what does work? What are the best practices? How do we share them more effectively and more quickly? Like, we should always do that. But if you don't have systems to plug it into that know how to take it, know how to adapt it, know how to problem solve for the things that aren't working and push to the next level, we can't, won't ever be able to serve all our kids well. So we need both.
You've seen a lot of communities doing this work, and probably know more about this than anyone I've ever met. What does it take to be successful at what you're describing?
So I'll say with all humility, I don't fully know, right? Because our aspiration is something that we've not seen. Our aspiration is that we serve every single child well, that we unleash the potential of every single child. And we're still figuring out how to do that. But I do know enough to know that there are some things that communities that are making progress in that direction share in common. They share in common that they actually do have outcomes that matter to them. They've agreed upon them and they pursue them with some relent. They have the data to actually do that and to inform each other about what's working and what's not. They pursue that work collectively. They recognize that there are lots of things going on and that fragmentation and incoherence is the enemy of progress. They have hard conversations. They have hard conversations about what's working and what's not, what's going to get resourced and what's not. They also have the other conversations about the hard issues in our communities, the hard issues of inequity and race that are difficult for people to have and have been until recently masked more than embraced. And the last thing I'll say is they have great leaders, great systems and strategies and all that stuff is great. But in the end, it is leadership that matters because they create the context for all the things that we just talked about.
Let's go down the road you just mentioned around until recently. Many of these inequities have been masked from some people, like they've been visible to many, masked to many. This last year has unmasked that in a way that's been quite remarkable. I think, talk to us about how you see this moment in time, both in terms of challenge and opportunity. Maybe let's think about it in terms of just racial equity awareness and racial reckoning, and then in terms of like economic recovery and inclusive recovery. There's a unique moment here. Tell us how you're thinking about that.
Yeah. The reality is that we had in 2020 the Band-Aid pull off a wound that's been festering for a very long time. And so for a lot of people, they are saying, wow, I can't believe that that has been there all this time and I didn't recognize it. And that's powerful and it's important and it's mobilized people. But I think what they don't really realize still for many people is that below that wound that is exposed on the surface, there is an infection that has run deep in the body of our country. And it affects all of our systems. And it shows up in ways that we live with it every day. And so you forget that it's actually there. And that we've learned behaviors that we don't even recognize that we have. We have biases that we would argue that we don't have. And that is the hard work that we have still to do, is to say, yes, there is the really viscerally appalling, very dramatic racist violence that we see that drew out people last summer. But deep in almost all of our systems in America are longstanding biases that keep people in place. I won't bore you with the chart, but I have one. And it's a chart from the 1930s of Chicago. It's a map that was drawn, and it was drawn to actually take advantage so that people knew how to deploy the mortgages that they were using at the time to stimulate the economy. And then I have on that very same chart a map of Chicago today that shows the economic mobility data that comes from a guy named Raj Chetty, who shows what economic mobility looks like down to the census tract level. And there is a part in that 1930s map that is marked red for redlining. And there's a part in that map from more recently about economic mobility that's red that looks exactly almost like the 1930s map, where it says there's no mobility still in the places that were marked red in the 1930s. And I could go through system after system after system and find things that were legal and government sanctioned. And I think by our standards today, we would say immoral. And yet we have got to find ways that we reckon with that and create pathways that can allow us to get to the kind of society that we aspire to, even in our own constitution.
What have you seen happening where that reckoning leads to productive action? Where do you see hope around the actual work to dismantle that?
Yeah. You know, I see it on multiple levels, actually. And I'll talk a lot about the folks I see doing this place-based work around the country. You know, it would be very easy for people who spend most of their time focused on the needs of low-income children or Black and brown children to sit on their high horse and say, we've been in this thing all along. But what I'm seeing now is people taking a much deeper look at themselves and how they operate, asking the question, have we actually shifted our mentality? Have we actually shifted any power to the communities that we say we are here to serve? Have we ever looked really hard at the ways that we're attacking the systems of oppression that exist in our communities? Do we have a policy agenda that actually starts to peel away those things that are designed to keep the status quo the way that it is? Or are we just doing interventions on top of it that assume that it has to be the way it is today? Are we embracing the people who are challenging us from the outside, asking us really hard questions because their lived experience does not correspond to the things that we say we think they need? And seeing people engage in that work and engage new people and look for new solutions, and most importantly, hold themselves accountable to doing something different, that's very exciting to me. The resources that people have committed, I'll be excited about when I see them move. There's a ton of resources that lots of companies have committed, lots of families or others have committed. And I just am curious to see in 3 years when we look back, how much of that money is going to have landed in communities and with people who are out there able to make a difference with it.
It seems very prescient that Blue Meridian Partners anticipated, I think, in some ways, this moment before the pandemic, anticipated the recovery moment when there would be choices, when mayors and city councils and county governments and legislatures would have a choice of what to do with recovery resources and how to design systems. And I'll just mention that the investments that Blue Meridian has made, I imagine all over the country, are changing the conversation with those civic leaders about what the future should look like.
I would hope so. The reality is that when we started this, we accelerated our timetable because of COVID without any indication of what was to come. But our core plan had at its center that the kind of systems you described to unpack where the inequity is, the centering not only of income, but of race in the work, that was a part of the conversation, the bringing to the table people from neighborhoods and communities and giving them voice in the solutions that were crafted was one of the few things that we asked very directly. And so, hate to think about luck in any of the context of what we've been talking about, but they do say that luck is when preparation meets opportunity. And I do think that we were prepared in this case to help communities start moving down a path that's become even more urgent during this time. But what is true though is that we were working at a scale that they could not have anticipated what's about to happen. And so the question for all of us is, unprecedented resources are going to land. $1.9 trillion has just been disbursed. It will go out over the next weeks. And the question is, what are we going to do with it that is not only going to fill gaps for today, but build platforms for how we address inequity for the long term in the future?
Yeah. Well, I can assure you that mayors and civic leaders here in the Salt Lake region have connected those dots. And in an inclusive recovery strategy meeting yesterday, we're contemplating that fact, those unprecedented resources, but doing it within the context of shifting power and changing systems.
That's incredibly exciting. And one of the reasons, obviously, that we pick communities in this first wave is not only to support them, but because we need exemplars. We need people who can show what it looks like to actually do that and to show that if you do it, it actually turns out different outcomes. So I'm just grateful that you and the other leaders who are involved in the work are setting that example and hope that we can illuminate it for folks around the country.
We're excited about it too. I want to turn to some of the questions that have been posted in the Q&A section. But before I do, let me ask you, is there anything maybe that I haven't asked you that you think is just important for people involved in this work here in the Salt Lake region to know?
I think that there's something I want everyone around the country to focus on right now. It is March. School will restart in August in most places in the country, largely in person. Lots of energy has been put into work around opening school safely, physically. Not a lot of work in many places has been put into, well, what are all of the things that our young people are going to need to be successful when they return? There's a lot of conversation about academic learning loss, but I'm begging communities to sit back and say, well, what do we need to actually re-engage our students before we start to pound academics into their head? How do we identify what other supports that they need before we start to try and get them to do more math or do more reading? How do we support their families through this transition, recognizing it's going to be bumpy for everyone? And how do we not do what we always do, is get insular in a time of crisis and turn to each other to actually get it done? So I'd say to you, I know it's a generic answer, but and I know you guys are leaning into this in a meaningful way, but I just say to everyone, this isn't like, it's cliche to say all hands on deck, but it is an all hands on deck moment. And if everyone can come together in this moment, I know we can produce for our kids something that they've never seen before. And it'll matter for years and years to come.
Yeah. I think that's a super powerful reminder. And in that work, as we've leaned into it here, one of the challenges we've noticed, I wonder if you've seen this around the country, is schools, for a variety of reasons, are like feel under the gun and have even before the pandemic, perhaps so much so that it's often hard to take an all hands on deck approach. That doing that, which clearly I think everybody intellectually gets, but the process of stepping back and saying, okay, it's worth me as a teacher or a principal or a district official, it's worth building some all hands on deck strategies, because it feels like the fires that are burning right now maybe are too hot. Do you see that in other places?
I see it all over. The reality is that school districts are under a lot of pressure. We've asked our school systems to solve all the problems, to deal with whatever trauma shows up in the school, to deal with the health issues that show up in school, to deal with social emotional problems that haven't been diagnosed, to catch kids up when they've been left behind. Like, we ask our schools to do a tremendous amount, and we hold them accountable for academic outcomes without considering the context in which those outcomes are produced. So I want to be really clear about that, because if we want a different outcome, if we don't a different set of behaviors, we've got to change the context in which people are trying to do their work too. The second thing is that oftentimes communities have not organized themselves to make taking support relatively easy.
Yeah.
So there are, I have no doubt that things in Salt Lake City are like a lot of cities, hundreds of nonprofits, hundreds of companies that would actually want to do something. And to ask a school system to set up an apparatus to receive all of that, it's a big ask. So without doing an advertisement, like, this is where, frankly, the apparatus that you set up, the partnerships that you set up, ought to kick in, right? It ought to be easier for a school system to turn to an outside partner and say, while we get ready for the hard work of getting kids ready academically, of integrating new tools and systems like the integrated social services, we'll do that. But there's a bunch of stuff that we really need you to kind of, if not do, coordinate for us so we can receive it more easily.
Yeah.
And if you can provide that service, if you can position yourself that way, I think you'll find a lot more districts ready to take it. And if not, then I hope others will encourage them to take that first step, because, you know, trust is hard to come by.
Trust is hard to come by. That's right. We could have a whole nother conversation about building trust in these relationships. But I want to turn to questions from our attendees today. The first one is, My Brother's Keeper initiative centers Black men and boys in as the focus. Many Black queer feminists have called for gender and race to be equally centered when thinking about any social issue. Mm-hmm. Think about gender and intersectionality in education.
Sure. So I'll say it focuses on boys and young men of color, broadly speaking. So African American. So I don't need to enumerate it. And one of the things that we were trying to do is to say, there's a concept called targeted universalism, is to say, if you focus on a specific population that you know has extraordinary need relative to others, and you focus on how you actually design to support those needs, do you actually begin to develop systems that serve everyone else better? The second thing is that one of the things that happened is that we have not been disaggregating data across any of those dimensions. We would only, it was very interesting, at the federal level, until My Brother's Keeper, you could only look at data by race or by gender, not even, and that's the binary gender, not even gender within race. And so the question is, how do we actually begin to build systems that recognize the range of different identities that wind up needing to be supported and served? How do you ultimately drive to serving students at the level of one? And what are the steps that you take along the way? So My Brother's Keeper started by focusing on boys and men of color, because that was the issue that kind of raised up the need to do differentiated interventions. But the tools and resources are ones that actually can benefit all of the populations that tend to be disenfranchised in this country. As we think about what it looks like going forward, almost all of the work is exactly that. It is enter the work, disaggregate the data, identify what the differences are by population type of a whole range of things, and then recognize within even the populations that we call like boys and young men of color, that there are a range of identities within that that need to be addressed equally as well.
Yeah, awesome. Some question that I was just looking at disappeared. So I'll go to the next one. How do you shift power to communities authentically and avoid doing that in a performative way?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we all have a lot to learn about what that really looks like, but here's what I'll say. There's a community input. You have lots of meetings and people get to stand up and tell you what they think. There's community engagement where people actually get to be involved in design processes. And then there's a shift in power where people get to be involved in this actual decision-making with you. And the real way you know if a community has power is whether or not they ultimately get to have a vision, their community look like, their vision of what they want their community to look like. And you're in the business of serving them to do so. Now, it's a really interesting thing because some people think that that means taking a philosophy of like, all the answers are in the community and all you need to do is give them the resources and get out of the way. And what I would say, given my background, as you said, there's this thing called human-centered design that has become very well-known in business sectors and folks like Apple and others do it. And the idea is that, yes, no one knows better than you what your problems are or what job you're trying to do. And you will always have really creative ideas about how to do it. But there is a reason that there are engineers. They bring a certain kind of expertise as well. There's expertise you get from your lived experience, and there's an expertise that you get from certain kinds of training and resources. There's exposure to others that have done that similar kind of thing. And it's by bringing those things together that you can craft solutions together that maybe neither one of you could have imagined. So yes, communities ought to have not only voice, but control over the solutions that come into their communities and how their communities turn out. But it doesn't mean that you can't engage in an authentic way to help craft the best possible solution together.
Yeah, interesting. What you've been describing is the necessity of developing a collective strategy. Yet we currently live in an America so divided that the term equity itself has become a lightning rod. How do we proceed? How do we speak honestly about what has occurred and is occurring in America and build a broader collective rather than further alienating one another?
Really easy questions tonight.
We've got sharp partners here.
So I'll give the best answer I can on this one. I'll tell you, I take a lot of inspiration from things that I see happen in communities that, consider themselves conservative. And what I mean by that is, let's take a place like Texas or Dallas, right? Except for a couple of places in Texas, it voted overwhelmingly Republican, and not only Republican in support of the last president. And at the same time as all that was happening, and even for decades before, you look at Texas and they had the equivalent of the Dreamers Act a decade before there was the Dreamers Act. Texas passed a law that said that regardless of what high school you went to, if you were in the top 10%, you ought to have access to the flagship institutions in the state, and then put in place systems to support it. So the reality is that my point on this is, and Dallas just recently took a hard look, and Dallas is not the most liberal city in Texas, in a state that's relatively conservative. Dallas took a look at their city and said, where have we historically underinvested, in fact, deliberately underinvested, and should we and could we pass a bond to actually drive funding to those places to fill those gaps, and then did it. So you say, amidst all of that rhetoric, where people that they had started talking with their labels would have been at war, you had things getting done for people in communities that actually created real pathways and real opportunity at the same time. So I think that the more we focus on our children, the more we recognize that, yep, every human, whether they are in a rural part of the state or in a city, really ought to be born healthy, if at all possible. They really ought to have resources, and their families ought to have resources around to take care of them in their early stages of life. They really ought to get what they need to enter school ready. And I just keep going through that pathway again. That's something that we can all agree that we want for our children. It's something that we oftentimes don't even fight about what good looks like. And then we work on those things.
Awesome. Awesome examples. Let's go back to schools for a minute. Can you give an example of the type of thing you like to see schools and districts do over the coming months and into the summer as students return to schools?
Yeah.
Is it, starting a week early? Is it just reconnecting with kids? Is it having summer programming? Is it just kids? Is it families? Like, what's the ideal dream?
So the short answer is yes. So the reality is that re-engagement is a thing. And so reaching out to the families, reaching out to kids, especially the kids who we know have been disconnected or have struggled during this period, not only reaching out to them, but getting them some resources and getting them some, I'll call it diagnostic assessments. Not only what is their status academically, but where are they socially, emotionally? Do they need any mental health supports? This has been traumatic times for a lot of people. And so how do we actually understand where the young person is, where a young person is, what's going on enough in their household so we can know what kind of supports they might actually need? Use the summer to do more support and re-engagement. You can use volunteers, you can use whatever peers, you can use lots of things, but it's about relationships that form real connection to a young person as they're making this transition back in the school, asking the questions about what their plans are, what their aspirations are, and what they need to help them to be successful. We know that kids need good learning opportunities and frankly, ones that are going to be interesting, right? Like I can't emphasize enough how important engagement, not just connection, but engagement is going to be during this period to get kids back in the business of really, really pressing themselves academically for many of them. And then lastly is integrating into the school environments the kinds of supports that are going to be necessary, especially during this period, initial period, to provide the social emotional supports to kids, as well as any accelerated learning opportunities that might be necessary through tutoring or other things like that. Like those are the biggest things. And if the school has not already adopted a curriculum that allows for targeting the specific needs of kids and tailoring instruction, then they ought to be looking hard at that stuff too.
This might be a too specific a question, but do you see any school districts simply saying, look, we got to go to year round. Like we need all, it's all hands on deck, but we don't need, like, we can't have a summer this year.
I haven't seen anybody go quite that far, but I have seen folks add a month on. And I do think that right now we're starting to see people say, actually, we need to just rethink what we're doing. We've learned some things. You know, we've learned that this hybrid thing, it actually can work better than we thought, right? It's very interesting. I won't say the name of the organization, but there's an organization where most of their curricular resources are online. And so they get to see what's happening across the country. And what they found was there was a huge heterogeneity about whether kids stayed on track or whether they didn't. And when they went to figure out what the difference was, it was whether or not the schools and school districts were stay committed to actually making sure that kids were continuing to make progress. And in the places where they did that, they made at least as much progress as they would have in the normal school year. Think about that, right? So you got a completely disruptive school system, but because the leadership made the decision that, hey, we see you're not online in a day, we're calling your house. We're asking what you need, and we're going to stick with you to make sure you're there. That kind of rigor applied to supporting our young people paid off. And it paid off in an online environment. So now the question is, okay, so what did we learn about how that can look in school? What do we learn about how we do integrate these other supports and services into the school building? We're going to learn a lot about how to accelerate learning. There was a recent study that was released on Monday that showed the real impact of high doses tutoring and how exactly it actually pays off, even when it's a little bit more expensive, because of you're able to move kids equivalent basically 2+ years in a year. Those things are things that we need to continue to experiment and create the environments that help kids feel like they belong.
Yeah. We have a pilot going on here in one of our partnership schools that combines mentoring, tutoring with online instruction, and they've shown similar gains. Yeah,
I'd love to learn more about it.
Yeah. Let's step back to kind of another systemic question and ask, how do we disrupt inequitable systems even as we work within them and are often funded by them?
Yeah. This is really, again, all these really easy questions. I had this conversation last week, and as you know, it's a funny thing when you used to, for most of your, for many of us, we were the younger person until you weren't, right? And there was this whole conversation with this group about, not trying not to center the current power structures in the work, right? Because that's what you're trying to get past. And at a certain point, I just kind of said, the reality is that there are certain things that I don't have to like, but they still are. And the truth is that resources and power still sits in many systems. And until we have something different, we have to figure out how to bend them to our will, to have them do the best they can to meet our kids' needs and have our kids learn how to take full advantage of imperfect systems. But never, 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 never give up our accountability for creating the new system. So the reality is that creating these contexts where we can begin to do the work to design something new that starts with the notion that every kid has their ability to reach their full, the highest potential, that actually you have to center difference, right? In order to be clear that you can produce equitable outcomes, right? Back to that earlier question, one way to make sure that you're actually addressing the needs of all of those different categories of intersectionality is to make sure that you can meet the need of each child. Like, as soon as we can serve each child, then all of a sudden those labels become a lot less important. They become a part of how you serve each child, but you no longer say, how do I serve Black, straight boys? You say, how do I serve Byron? Mm-hmm. Who happens to be, but he has a lot of other things too. And then we can produce systems that, when they can serve each child, can help them reach their full potential.
That powerful idea of serving the needs of each child and differentiating instruction seems well embraced and seems super hard to do from within the system. Especially Utah is a state that has the lowest per pupil funding. And we do a great job here. Like, I don't want to suggest that our schools don't do really well with that, but we have larger than average class sizes, and I'm not sure that class size is the biggest barrier to differentiating instruction from within the system and meeting the needs of each child. I'm curious if you've seen examples where teacher training programs or other ways of helping teachers embrace that vision if they don't already have it and then be able to do it.
So I've been very fortunate that prior to leaning into the work around place-based work, I spent most of my time leaning in around education. I've seen some really phenomenal models where the schools have been designed around that intention, that one, that belief that you can actually get every single kid to that level of performance. And then the second is then you design around the needs of the kid to produce that outcome. And so whether it's leaning in around a school like Valor and they're focused on social emotional needs of kids and how they learn to actually navigate those with other students in their school, or whether it's schools like Summit that are able to create real agency by providing opportunities for personalized pathways for kids, where they get a lot of choice, but they also get a lot of challenge and support along the way. The thing that's interesting about this is that we talk about these new school models, but if you look back at the roots of either Piaget or Montessori, they were designed around this basic concept of providing controlled choice in ways that allowed you to meet every kid where they are and then take them all, but not stop until you take them all the way to the end. And somehow we've lost that as we design systems. And sometimes even in the name of being fair or just, we've created ways that we actually don't attend to the specific needs of kids and instead lump them together, not serving any of them particularly well.
Well, we're gonna wrap up with just a couple more questions. I wonder if we could move into the higher education space and get your thoughts about how is post-secondary education How should post-secondary education be thinking about the same challenge of coming out of a pandemic and transitioning kids from a, you know, many kids from a senior year of high school that was not at all what anybody expected? What should we be doing there?
So I'm smiling because I'm a father of a graduating senior. And a father of a graduating senior who, like every other graduating senior, largely has been locked up in the house for the last 18 months. So the first thing I want to tell people who are involved in higher education is imagine, you remember what your freshman classes are like in a normal year when kids experience that freedom for the first time. Imagine what they're going to be like when they show up on campus after being locked up for 18 months, showing up on campus for the first time with that kind of freedom. For all of us as parents, the scary thought is that a lot of the experiences and rites of passage that usually happen in your junior and senior year of high school won't have happened for these young people. They'll be happening for the first time when they're away from home and away from you. So what I would say to all of us is there's a way of caring and wrapping ourselves around young people because they're going to need a little bit more structure and support when they arrive than we're used to having to provide. The second thing is that I think that none of us really fully realize the level of trauma that has come from this experience. And that really having strong mental health supports and other counseling supports on campus for kids, so that when the thing that is the hard adjustment of being away from home for those kids who are actually away at school shows up, that when it is amplified by the other trauma that is already they're already bringing, that they're the kind of supports that are there that might normally have been able to address by an RA. Most importantly, what I'd say is that you got to recognize that there's going to be a lot of variable learning experiences that the seniors classes this year are going to have had as they enter their freshman years. And so they may have graduated, but it may not look like what the normal senior year looked like academically or any other way. And so the scaffolding that they need to be successful needs to be there. Now, I say all that focused on the folks that are entering, probably because I'm worried about my son. But the other thing that we need to recognize is that we have allowed our post-secondary education to do three things that are really challenging. Number one is we had started down a path where actually you at least had transparency around whether kids were graduating, whether they were graduating and they were being employed, and whether they'd be employed in a way that would allow them to pay their debt. And that transparency could allow folks to make informed decisions about which schools that they were choosing. And in the very worst cases, like literally the very worst cases, like single digit graduation rates, the federal government had the opportunity to say no more money for you. Right? And we've gotten away from that and we've got to get back to that. So that's number one. Number two is that we've allowed the cost of education to get to a point where if you access it, you are burdened with a level of debt afterward that makes it still prohibitive, where you are actually in many cases making it more difficult for people to go up the economic ladder as opposed to easier for them to do so. But the third thing is that we've continued to believe that the way that we've been doing post-secondary, because it was the right way and we were at the head of the pack 3 decades ago, or 4 decades ago, or 5 decades ago, is the way we should be doing it today. And what is becoming more and more clear is that the half-life on skills is just getting shorter and shorter and shorter. And so the innovation that actually needs to happen at the post-secondary level is at least as much as needs to happen in the K-12. The thing that I think people lose sight of is that our dropout rate in college is much worse than it is in high school. We've now gotten almost to an 80% graduation rate in K-12, and we are still in the 30s. In post-secondary. And so just think about what that means about how much redesign work actually ought to be happening and how much better we ought to be tying it to things that matter in people's lives. Not that that vocation is the only reason to go to college, but it sure ought to be one of the things you can get out of it.
Yeah. That's a powerful way to end this. I want to ask one final question. So that wasn't the end, but we hope that these events, I feel enormously better prepared to go about this work by virtue of this conversation. But it is about work. It's not about a conversation here. This is learning and the next is doing. just give us one thing, and the folks who've joined us tonight, you know, one thing that you'd advise us all to do as we go act on what we're learning.
Go together. Go together. If you leave this webinar and you just go back to what you're doing and you don't think, there's no way for us to do what we need to do for our kids if we don't all pull together, then you missed the whole point. So my one piece of advice, find a way to go together.
That is the way to end. So Jim, thank you so much for being with us tonight. It's late where you are. We really, really appreciate it. I want to thank everybody who has joined us on this webinar tonight, who's joined us for our other speaker series events, who join us in the work that we do. If you are someone who hasn't yet joined us in this work of going together, please visit our website at uw.org. And we wish you all a very safe an excellent coming evening. And thank you all.
Good night, guys.
Take care.